This is Morgan Michael, welcoming you to Kindsight 101, the podcast, where you'll hear from world-renowned educational leaders about the mobilizing power of kindness, together by challenging our assumptions and venturing beyond the status quo in education. We can make a big impact, one small act at a time.
The simplicity of the skills, you know, paying attention, connecting, noticing feelings, I think it takes the pressure off. It's not, you know, it's not complicated stuff, but it does take practice and commitment.
Have you ever wondered what the number one predictor for high-achieving teams was? What about optimizing the brain's most basic neurochemicals to live a happier life? Did you know that there are three main ingredients to creating belonging in the workplace, and anyone, irrespective of title, can contribute to doing so? In our episode with Gail Markin, we'll be answering these questions and more. I was totally blown away by the TED Talk that this amazing educator gave this past summer and want to share all the juicy learning with you. You can connect with her at Markin Gail on Twitter. Gail Markin is a middle school counselor and a district support teacher for social emotional learning in Langley, British Columbia. She has a background in social work, family counseling, and parent education. Gail is a member of the BC School Centered Mental Health Coalition, Social Emotional Learning BC, and the Langley School District Wellness Team. She is passionate about promoting and supporting mental health and wellness for all. Gail Markin, I just want to say thank you so much for joining me today on Kindsight 101. It is a pleasure to have you, and I'm super excited to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here.
So you work in BC as a school counselor and as a leader in many different social emotional learning leadership organizations. And can you speak just briefly to your role, just so we can contextualize who you are for the listeners?
Yeah, so in my district, I work helping support teachers and pretty well everybody around social emotional learning skills and practice and things like that. So I get the opportunity to do that in that role. I'm really excited. I've started, but we're just at the beginning stages of doing some work supporting mental health and wellness in sort of rural and remote school districts. So we're going to, and I'm doing that with the BC Children's Hospital and a project of theirs. And so we're going to go and work with districts to see where they're at in their journey towards like mental health and wellness and where they want to go and how we can support them with that. So really excited about that. And then I have the opportunity to work with a group called Social Emotional Learning BC, which is a sort of lower mainland focused in our province, a sort of area of our province where we're also working among school districts and researchers to kind of take the research around this area and put it into practice. So it's kind of that back and forth. They do wonderful research. And if we have questions, we can say we'd really love to know more about this. And then they get to try out their research and join with school districts and sort of say, we'd really like to answer this question. And they come into the schools and work with us that way. So it's a really wonderful way to share back and forth. And then the other one that I'm really excited and proud to be part of is something called the BC School Centered Mental Health Coalition, which again brings a whole bunch of people who are interested in health and well-being together, and particularly focused on the K-12 education system. So that is lots of fun.
That's fantastic. Thank you for bringing us through that. And I know that I've attended one of the social emotional learning conferences through British Columbia, and it was really amazing because, like you said, there were doctors in the field of mental health medicine and then also in education, and the bridge between the two was really remarkable. So it's neat to be seeing this kind of focus on mental health, wellness, and social emotional learning in our province. It's something to be proud of for sure. So I want to delve into some of the topics that you talked about in your TED Talk, because your TED Talk, first of all, was really well done, and it was really interesting, but it was also entertaining to watch. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you had an opportunity to see it. It was a bit of a new experience for me doing the TEDx But I really, really wanted to spread the message. I've been doing all of this reading and seeing all of this wonderful stuff. And I just thought, I just want to get it out there to people. So
that's fantastic. And I want to delve into some of that today. So when you started your talk, you said that there was one thing that you believe that all people basically need in order to stay motivated, to live longer lives, and to be the most successful, happy human beings that they can possibly be. Can you speak to what that is and how we get there?
Absolutely. So the title of the talk was The Secret to Health, Happiness, and Success. And honestly, the answer to that is belonging. It's about social connection. And I think that's one of the things that's so inspired me about this is that it's absolutely so simple and yet at the same time, so completely powerful. Belonging being like one of the most important drivers of human behavior. We all want to belong.
Mm-hmm. And you used some really wonderful examples in the talk. And I was really taken with the research around Google's Project Aristotle. So they really looked at belonging through the lens of teamwork. And so collaboration, teamwork, it's such a big part of our 21st century skills that we want to teach our students in order to prepare them for life and the workforce and what this very uncertain globalized world will bring. So I know that they sort of talked about there's no perfect performer, but that there are sort of like two main ideas or some driving forces that helped to identify kind of what makes a high performing team member.
Yeah. So the two main factors, and this sort of summarizes quite a bit of research. So I would encourage people to kind of look more in depth into it. But what they were so fascinated to find is they were trying to come up with, as you say, high performing teams. And they thought they could get the highest performers and put them all together. And they were looking at all these individual traits. And what they found was none of those individual traits mattered at all. What mattered was two things that were really, really important. The first one was social connection. So the people had a connection with each other. They mattered to each other. And the second one, along with that one, is that they felt like they had a safe environment where they were safe to share their ideas, that they didn't have to worry about making mistakes, that they knew the team kind of had their back. And so they could do things and be creative and try out new ideas, and no one was gonna, you know, make them feel silly or, you know, embarrassed or, you know, ship them out of the group if they messed up or if they said something that sounded different, right? So it's that psychological safety to be yourself and to be creative and that you know each other and that you care about each other, the basics of relationship and belonging.
That's so amazing. And it makes me think of, I read this book called Creativity Inc. about Pixar and how they came up with a lot of their creative ideas. And a really big part of what they did there was, the social connection piece, but then also this safe place to be creative, which means all of the totally wacky ideas that come out, not to discount them, but to leave them on the table, because those quite often spin off into other ideas or, you know, you can kind of grow a framework around these really ridiculous ideas and bring it back down to earth. But without the, you know, out there outlandish ideas, you really don't have the grounds for leaping into a new way of thinking. And so that creativity piece is so important, wouldn't you say, for school?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like, the best inventions in the world and all the wonderful things out there, they were never done by themselves, right? Like, you can sit and have great ideas, but if you have them in a group of people that you feel safe enough with to have them, you can come up with amazing things. We were never meant to do this all by ourselves. And I think the classroom is, I mean, Project Aristotle was the workplace. And I think the classroom is such a perfect example for the adult world, because teachers explicitly know that their kids need to belong and feel safe. And, you know, in order to be creative, they have to work together and bounce ideas off. I mean, that's what our classrooms do. And so it makes sense that that's what works in our workplaces as well. It's both, or it has to be. We're all people.
We are. And I think there's this human thread of social connection, right? And I'm a huge fan of Sean Acor, the Harvard professor and the multiple author, amazing, amazing person. And his research is truly incredible around happiness. Can you speak to a little to some of the things that he asserted in terms of what's important in terms of creating a sense of happiness and fulfillment in our lives?
Well, yeah, I mean, he talks a lot about happiness research. And one of the things that he found is that all of these individual characteristics and things like that that create happiness, first of all, we're always trying to get to them, right? We have to experience them in the moment and quit trying to, you know, if I can only get here, if I could only get to that next promotion or that next thing, we have to actually experience in the moment all of them. But he said, even then, like, you can get to a certain level of it. But if you do it together, if you have that social connection, he did a very similar study to Google and found the same kind of things, like what contributes to our happiness and success. And again, he just very much like the Google study found that those individual attributes really didn't make much difference. It was our social connection with each other. Like, social connection was the best predictor of happiness and academic success in his study with Harvard students. And yeah, we can get to a certain level of individual happiness by ourselves. You know, we can practice gratitude and we can, you know, do all those wonderful things around the social emotional competencies. We can be self-aware and we can, you know, do acts of kindness. We can do all those things, but our potential, and that's the name of his book, his latest book, Big Potential, for success and happiness, when we do that in connection with others, is exponentially greater.
Oh, that's so significant. So essentially, we can do all of these things in silos as individuals, but really, truly, to really push it to the next level in terms of really being fulfilled, it's about the connection to one another as we're doing a lot of these things. So that's really interesting. Do you, in your role, would you say that there are a few standout examples of ways that you've seen educators actually put into practice some of these activities that really highlight social connection?
So I don't know, I was thinking about this, and one of the things I think is important for teachers to know is that it is important to actually explicitly teach the skills and embed it into practice. So I think the most powerful, you know, practical experiences are the things where you've actually talked about things, like, for instance, for example, so teaching about feelings, right? So everybody knows what feelings are, but in a way, have we really explicitly talked about them? One of the things that we know about, if we want to increase our self-awareness and our other awareness as well, is that we should be increasing our feelings vocabulary. So there's a simple thing that teachers can do in the classroom with students for themselves as well. Honestly, every time I say something that we can do with our students, we also need to be doing it with ourselves. So increasing our vocabulary of feelings, simple again, right? But if we explicitly do that with kids, they can start to understand that sad is different than depressed, or angry is different than frustrated. It gives those nuances of feelings. It helps us communicate with each other better. Something as simple also as teaching students what feelings feel like in your body. I mean, we call them feelings for a reason. The first place we find them is in our bodies. So if I, for example, which is true for me, even as I'm talking to you, I'm touching my chest. That's where my feelings are. I get a tightness in my chest if I'm feeling something. If I know that and I'm aware of that, that's some kind of feeling, I honestly don't even need to know exactly what feeling it is right at the moment. I just need to notice it's happening.
Right.
Yeah, so teachers explicitly teaching that to kids to be aware of where they hold their feelings in the body, and also that there's lots of similarities between all of us, but we're all slightly different. Sort of showing that, using themselves as an example, like I just did, said when I feel something, I get a tightness in my chest, and then helping them learn that we need to be curious about that. We don't actually have to react to it right away, right? We don't have to do something about it. We just have to be curious.
Right. So one is through probably literature or even just viewing videos or role play, really exploring the vocabulary then around the emotions. And I know Dr. Brené Brown has a wonderful list of basic human emotions on her website as well, which I can link. And there's so many different resources, right? But that's a nice one. And then the second is actually having them figure out where in their body they tend to hold their feelings or express their feelings. And then finally, giving them permission to be curious as opposed to reactive about those feelings. So that's a wonderful strategy right there to keep your finger on throughout the year, because those moments really, it is explicit, but it's tough because it's one of those things that sometimes those situations just arise in context of the classroom, right? Like you may kind of have a plan in your head, and then this is the perfect moment to delve into this lesson once again and revisiting it over and over and over, right?
Yes, absolutely. And sometimes it's just in that moment. And it's also talking through it when it happens with you.
That's great. And I like that connection to yourself. Again, like modeling how to work through that, because it's one thing to talk about it. It's a whole other thing to actually live through it and then show how challenging that can be, right? And so I would like to talk a bit about that emotional pain and the way that it fits into our bodies. And I thought it was so fascinating in your talk, the way that you explored the research around physical pain and emotional pain. Basically, the fact that we perceive and remember physical pain and emotional pain differently. And so would you speak to that a little bit and how it might be relevant to the way that we speak about feelings and experiences in the classroom?
Yeah, so this is the work of Matthew Lieberman, and I'm sure others, but it was his book that I read that, I watched his TED Talk and very fascinated by that and was sort of repeating it when I was doing my TEDx. I find that when we experience rejection or social pain, it lights up the same parts of our brain as register physical pain. But when you think about it, it kind of makes sense, right? And what I said in the TED Talk, and what really got to me, is when you think about or you recall physical pain, you describe it to people in words, but you're not actually physically feeling it in your body. And yet emotional pain, and this is what people would mostly describe if you were to ask them, what's the most painful experience you've ever had? They usually don't discuss the physical pain. They would usually talk about an emotional pain, like the death of someone they loved, or a big rejection, or something that really hurt them at an emotional level. And when you talk about those experiences, like if I were to tell you a story of an emotional pain in my life, you actually start to feel it physically in your body. I think for me, the reason that it's so fascinating and why I think it's important for people to understand that is, number one, it really reminds us the huge importance of relationship. Yeah, and getting it right as often as we can. Yeah, just also being aware that if we don't get it right, which we won't always, is that it is important to correct it, to talk about it, to fix things up, to get back in relationship with each other.
If you've maybe said something or done something that creates a wound for someone else, and you don't make the efforts to perhaps like explore and make it better and find a way to build a bridge, it can be damaging, right? And so being able to, and physically almost, right? That it stays with us on such a deep level. And so, yeah, that's an important thing. And teaching kids about that although maybe your intent isn't to hurt someone in a long lasting way, your words can have a really deep impact on someone and can be emotionally impactful in a way that perhaps, physical pain may or may not be. and even telling them about that experiment that Matthew Lieberman did and showing them that explicitly, that depending on their age, obviously, but showing them those brain scans and saying, look, this is what it looks like. This is what behavior, or even I don't love the word bullying because the true definition is quite narrow, but you know, the bullying type behavior that actually has lasting consequences. And I think some of our questioner brain kids who really like to have that concrete, tangible evidence of their learning, I mean, that really makes sense to people. I could see that really being something that they hang on to.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also gives us the opportunity to then talk about how, yeah, it is harder to fix that when we've hurt someone emotionally. It is a harder fix in many ways, but it can be done, and allowing us to then, well, how do we do it? Well, we have then an experience of goodness, right? So
yes,
this person has been hurt, and now I have the opportunity to do something to show them my goodness, because
yes,
that's, you know, that's who I am and that's who I need them to see. And we both get to experience my goodness after that.
Yes. No, that makes sense.
Yeah. So, and from the kid level, and I guess too, what I also loved about the research from the adult level, looking at working with kids and also working with each other, is that we have to be really careful when we know that that causes that physical pain. We are hugely motivated to avoid that pain. And one of the things that we want to be careful of is we don't want to kind of armor up from that pain. Again, to use probably Brené Brown's words, right?
Yes.
Is that we become aware of the fact that it is really hurtful, like physically hurtful, to think about that kind of stuff. So our tendency is to kind of, you know, want to just move away from it or put up whatever kind of armor we have to protect ourselves from feeling that. And so many, yes, particularly adults at this point, because we've had years of doing this, have developed a kind of, you know, I don't really have feelings, or I don't really react to feelings. And what we know is that they do have feelings, but they've got these big sort of armors of protection that may have served them well as children, in order to stay safe or for whatever reason they needed to do that. And we simply don't need them anymore. And they start to get in our way.
Oh, that is such a profound point. I mean, this is a recurring thing that can often stand in the way of success or achievement, actually, too, or just general well-being, is that we armor up. You're absolutely right. And that it doesn't serve us any longer. However, it's really hard to detach ourselves from that armor because we're used to that safety and that certainty, right?
They are getting in the way of relationship, which, again, we now know it's where creativity comes from. It's where success comes from. And the more we have these armors up that say, you know, I'm afraid of being hurt, so therefore I won't connect, therefore I'll reject, or I'll, you know, I won't bother doing the fix up. If we've had a problem, I'll just back away. I'll just say, okay, I'm not going to deal with you anymore. You know, that kind of thing.
Yes. Yes. The cold shoulder or whatever, right?
Absolutely. Or I'll go, you know, deal with someone else. I won't fix it up with you, but it's not gone. It's still there, and it's stopping us from being our greatest potential, because we're social beings. And yeah, so I just think they're all kind of connected. And that's why I love it really goes back to relationship.
But I mean, if you were to give advice to a leader, what are some essential components that would contribute to a positive culture and creating a positive culture? What are some things that an administrator or even a teacher, I mean, often teachers don't see themselves as leaders, but we are leading a big class of human beings every single day. So what are some components that we can do to establish that culture of belonging?
So yeah, absolutely. Teachers are leaders. And the answer for if you're in the classroom, or if you're a leader of adults, or whatever you are as a leader, is the same. It's the same social emotional competencies that you want to teach and model and make explicit. So again, things like how we handle conflicts, or how we make our meetings safe, right? How do we do that? But what does that explicitly look like? Like, we can say we can get our list of values at the beginning of the year. In classrooms, we do this wonderfully, right? We
Yes.
ask all the kids, we get all their impact. How are we going to work together? We get their input into that. We say we're going to work together like this. We're going to show respect. And in the classroom, we say, what does showing respect look like, right? And we
Yes.
make it explicit
Yes.
for kids. The same thing we should do with our groups and teams as adults. So we have a meeting, we meet once a month, and you know, whatever work team that is, we should at the beginning say, these are the way we're going to work together. Everyone gives input to that, but what does that look like, right? So we talk about our school or our district values, for instance. One of the things that comes to mind for me is, say, courage. Courage is one of our values. Well, what does that actually look like in a meeting? Does that look like everyone speaks? Does that look like when people speak, we're really clear to make sure that it's safe for them to do so, that we're supportive of people, that we don't interrupt? Like, we can come back to our values if in fact that's not happening. We can say, oh, remember, you know, that we're not interrupting in meetings. And, you know, like, we can do that because those are our values we came up with together. So
yes,
it's so wonderful that we're in education, because we kind of know what we're doing in the classroom in many, many ways. And especially if we're looking at the social emotional learning competencies. And what, as adults, I think we need to do is remind ourselves that the same things apply in the adult world.
I think everybody could probably point to a situation in a staff meeting or just a general interaction with leadership or otherwise, you know, colleagues, and it's gone sideways.
Absolutely. One of the best examples of that is, and it's in, like, if you look at some of the social emotional awareness competencies around conflict resolution. We in classrooms have sort of ways that we try and teach the kids, and we could probably do better with this as well, right? How do we solve conflict? You know, what do we do? But we're pretty good at it. We need that kind of same place in the workplace. So in education, but also in lots of other workplaces, we need to be explicit around conflict being okay, right? If we all had the same ideas, that would be a bad thing. But we need to know that it's okay. And what does it look like? And how do we want to behave with it? And what happens when it gets too big? Like, how do we approach that? Yeah, and that's just one of the examples. But if you look at the social emotional learning competencies, self-awareness, how do you manage your emotions, you know, social awareness, how we support each other, they're in the classroom and they're in the workplace.
Mm-hmm. And so, so important as well. I was thinking about Daniel Coyle's culture code. I loved his three essential ingredients. Can you speak to those a little bit?
So Daniel Coyle, in his book, The Culture Code, talks about something called belonging cues. And he had the opportunity to go inside some of the world's most successful organizations. And what they found is that they could figure out who would be the most successful teams and groups based on the levels of belonging cues in conversations and within these groups. So belonging cues are cues that, or things that people do in groups to promote connection. So things like eye contact and proximity to each other and turn taking and all those kind of things that we do in order to sort of communicate with each other in groups. And what he said was belonging cues have three essential ingredients. The first one is energy. So there has to be some kind of an investment in the interaction. We're invested in some way. And then the second one is individualization. So it lets the other person know that they themselves are unique and valued.
And right. Okay.
Yeah. And then the third one is future orientation, which is basically saying that this relationship will continue. And it wasn't so much that necessarily, you know, the job or the project or, you know, we'll always work together kind of thing, but that the relationship between us will continue. So if I see you on the street after the project's over, we still have a relationship. So it had some kind of future orientation. So, you know, and basically you can sum up these three essential ingredients into one simple phrase: you are safe. And Yeah, it kind of goes back to some of the other things that we were talking about and some of the other research. And, you know, when you think about it, really, if you want people to be successful, that's what you want. You want them to feel safe. You want them to know that our interaction together is important to me, that you yourself are unique and valuable to me, that it's not just sort of anyone who could be here. I actually care about you. And that our relationship will continue. So, you know, I guess the thing is that if you want to have success and all those wonderful things that belonging gives us, that's the way to do it. You know, focus on the relationship that you have with people. And yeah, these belonging cues are kind of proof of that, I guess, in the workplace.
I
So.
love that. I just, you know what? I think that that applies. I think about it within a colleague situation. I think about it with admin and employee, but I also think about it with parents, because if we can send those same cues to parents that we are invested in that interaction, that our communication is individualized to them. So yes, obviously we're going to send blanket emails or, you know, blanket newsletters because that's efficient, but then also having the time to have conversations that show that individual that they are important, and then finally that the relationship continues. So beyond the student conference or the parent-teacher conference, that yes, I am still available for you. And I think that just kind of you going through that really made me connect it to parents, because I think that's an important piece as well.
Absolutely. And then the students, right? This exact,
Absolutely.
yeah, the exact same thing in all of those different relationships. The person and the relationship matters.
Yes. Before we move on to our rapid fire questions, is there anything that you want the listeners to hear, or a message that you think is really important to communicate that you haven't really had a chance to do so?
Just that reminder to people that it is not complicated stuff. It's fairly simple stuff, but it actually takes some effort because it takes practice. And even like this is something that's kind of a work in progress. The simplicity of the skills, you know, paying attention, connecting, noticing feelings. I think it takes the pressure off. It's not, you know, it's not complicated stuff, but it does take practice and commitment. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah, yeah, yeah. Simple, not easy, right?
Yes, that's exactly it.
Yeah. So, what does kindness mean to you?
Kindness to me is sort of coming from that place of positive intent and starting with that same assumption for others. It's not necessarily nice or that warm and fuzzy stuff that people think it is. Sometimes it is, and often it is, but it does involve some kind of inherent assumption of wanting the best for someone and treating with them with goodness and care.
What one skill does an educator need to lead with in order to be effective?
Oh, in order to be effective, an educator has to be patient, persistent, and imperfect.
Ah, that's a good one. I don't think anybody's ever said that one before. What one quote would you print on one of those quote cups that could be sold in bookstores across the world?
Well, you know, I don't know if it fits on the cup, but one of my favorite quotes is a Brené Brown quote because I just simply think she's wonderful. And it would be the one where she says leaders must invest a reasonable amount of time attending to fears and feelings, or squander an unreasonable amount of time trying to manage ineffective and unproductive behavior. I love that one. And I guess with, you know, great respect to Brené Brown, who I feel is kind of like my own personal life coach, I would actually insert my own line in there after leaders must invest a reasonable amount of time attending to fears and feelings. I would put a little bracket in there and say, including their own.
Yes, totally.
And
Totally.
I honestly think she'd be absolutely okay with that.
It probably just didn't fit on that page, that's all. Gail, thank you so much for joining me today on this conversation. It's been a lot of fun and I've learned a lot. And I know that my listeners will really enjoy hearing some of the examples and the ideas that you had as well. Where can people find you?
Ah, well, there's a good question. I don't have a website or anything. I probably should. But if they would like to watch my TEDx, they can search TEDx and Gail Markin.
Perfect.
And I hope they do. I would love it if they would watch and if they enjoy it and think it's interesting to spread it around, because that's the whole idea is to spread the word about the importance of belonging.
That's fantastic. And I have definitely shared it on my Twitter as well, and I'll be sharing it in my blog and on the show notes. So hopefully in that respect, you'll get some additional people who learn some of the important things that you share with us. So thanks again, Gail, for being here today.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
I want to thank you for the wonderful reviews that you've left for this podcast on iTunes. Your reviews make a big difference in helping other educators find this show. If you think that I'm doing good work here and you'd like others to get inspired and join our 21-day kindness challenge and movement, I'd love it if you would take a minute, head over to iTunes, and leave a review. Thank you so much. This has been another episode of Kindsight 101, the podcast. For links to resources mentioned in this episode, visit smallactbigimpact.com and click on our podcast and choose this episode number. Now, I'd love to give my audience a heads up about my new book, which will provide ideas, actionable strategies, and inquiry-based approaches to creating kinder classroom through serving the community. Subscribe to my blog for more information. Now, I would love to hear from you. What's the biggest insight that you gain from this conversation? Head over to our website, smallactbigimpact.com, leave a comment on our podcast page, or tag and connect with us on social media with the hashtag #SmallActBigImpact to share your inspiring story of kindness. Can't wait to hear from you.